This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It may be hard to believe, but it has been 25 years since Larry David's Show About Nothing debuted on NBC. In its pilot season, Kramer went by the name Kessler, and the character of Elaine did not exist. Nonetheless, Seinfeld was on its way to becoming an unexpected hit, transforming not only the TV sitcom, but the medium itself. And that's at least according to TV critic Matt Zoller-Seitz. In his New York Magazine article, How Seinfeld Paved the Way for Tony Soprano, he makes the case that Seinfeld set the scene for television's new anti-hero golden age. And Matt Zoller-Seitz, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
Now we embrace Seinfeld as this show about nothing. Can you bring us back to 1989? How risky was it putting the show on the air?
Well, I don't know. I don't know how risky it really was because they debuted the pilot when it was called The Seinfeld Chronicles in the summer. They sort of buried it. And the show, as you probably know, was close to death throughout the early part of its run because it just was not catching on with audiences. But then its things started to really kick in around season two, and thanks in part to the championing of this executive named Warren Littlefield, who was just a huge fan of it. But I have just been over this, and I really can't see any reason why Seinfeld should have been as unbelievably huge a hit as it was, considering that sort of show that it was, because most of the shows that were really big were warm shows. They were warmer than Seinfeld. Seinfeld's a cold show, which is not to say that it's not an enjoyable show, just that, as co-creator Larry David put it, there's no hugging, no learning.
Well, Seinfeld's contributions to comedy, very well documented. We have 30 Rock, Friends, The Office, Curb Your Enthusiasm, trying in some way to capture its glory. But you compare the character of Seinfeld to Tony Soprano. How are they similar?
Well, just in the sense, I mean it more in the sense of the relationship between the hero of the show and the audience, which is that we are watching this character behave in supremely self-interested, even selfish ways week after week. And I would say in a sense, although, you know, Seinfeld, obviously, he's not a drug-dealing, murderous gangster or anything. In terms of his human potential, I would say he has less going for him than Tony does. Because Tony, as loathsome as he was, you sat there week after week watching him in therapy with Dr. Melfi and thinking, there is potential in this man. There's potential for redemption. He can change. He was like Archie Bunker in that way. He was like Ralph Cramden. I mean, you knew that there was a core of sweetness in him, and as lovable as likable rather as Seinfeld was, he didn't have that. Like, you, what you saw was what you got, and that was always the case. And we learned more about Seinfeld and Elaine and Kramer and George Costanza and all these other characters as the show went along. But nothing that we learned made us think, "Oh, I had them all wrong. They're actually really sweet."
Well, he may not be a murderer, but Jerry Seinfeld does commit one very serious crime. Let's hear a clip from that.
All right, look, I'll tell you what. I'll give you $50. Now, be reasonable. You cannot turn down $50 for a $6 rye.
No. Watch me. Stop it.
I want that rye, lady.
No, someone help.
Shut up, you old pig.
Okay, Matt Zoller-Seitz. For those who haven't seen that episode, please tell us what's happening.
What's happening is Jerry really wants that marble rye. And he's willing to commit violence to get it. And there's so many characters. I recently was on a TV news show talking about the legacy of Seinfeld. And John O'Hurley, who played Jay Peterman, was on there with me. And he said the host of the show was trying to stick up for the Seinfeld characters and say that they really weren't all that bad. And he said, on the contrary, of those four major characters, not a single one of them would hesitate for one second to throw any of the others under a bus for any reason. And it's true. And that's what makes it so wonderful, is because Seinfeld, you kept thinking they're not going to go there, and then they do. And that's the source of the humor. And in a way, that's what links it with all of these kind of extreme cable dramas, where a big part of the appeal is – You're watching it. You think they can't possibly go there. That's too much. That's too extreme. It's too ridiculous. It's too loathsome. And then they do. And you go, wow. And then Twitter lights up and people call each other and they post on Facebook. Can you believe what that character just did? Well, Seinfeld was really the vanguard of that.
But there's something that we're cheering for. I mean, Walter White, the drug dealer from Breaking Bad, maybe not so much Frank Underwood, Kevin Spacey's character from The House of Cards. But there's a part of us that is cheering for them. I guess that's the sort of key to the anti-hero. I mean, was this an intentional thing, do you think, on the part of Larry David?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that it comes back to this idea that I always like to think of it as Seinfeld as being representative of an essential truth about comedy, the difference between comedy and drama, which is that drama is about how people change and grow or fail to change and grow because of a tragic flaw. Whereas comedy is about how people tend to revert to type.
Well, that may be true in the comedy world, but as you're talking about paving the way for many people are calling a sort of second golden age for television, really high quality television dramas with antiheroes often at the center. So what do you think is going on in our culture now that we're embracing that? And was Seinfeld the kind of gateway drug, I guess?
It was, yeah. And I think the key to it is that what Seinfeld proved, more so than I think any sitcom that had come before, and maybe any TV show that had come before, was there you don't have to approve of characters to find them interesting. Hmm. Shakespeare understood that, and I think Seinfeld and Larry David understood it too in their own way.
Matt Zoller-Seitz is with us. He is a television critic and also the editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com. We're talking about Seinfeld as breaking ground for the anti-hero role in many television dramas that are really popular today. Of course, you mentioned the other characters as also borderline despicable. There's something here's a scene that you write about in your article. George Costanza here responding to the death of his fiancée Susan. Why is this so significant, Matt?
It's significant because this is a major character who has gotten himself into a relationship that in theory should be redemptive, restorative. The moment where he transforms into a fully fledged human being, an adult male, a mensch, as it were. And she dies licking these poison envelopes. And it seems like it takes him about all 5 seconds to recover from it. And then he goes on as if nothing had happened. And I will never forget when that episode aired, I was a television critic at the Star Ledger in Newark, New Jersey. And I wrote about Seinfeld a lot. So did my buddy on the beat, Alan Sepinwall. Mm. And we got so much mail, so much email, so many letters about that, this little clip that we're about to hear, this moment, because people were really seriously asking themselves, can I continue to watch a show where somebody would behave like this? What does it say about me as a human being? You know, am I going to hell? Am I a bad person? Maybe I shouldn't be associating myself with a program like this. And that's that relationship that Seinfeld thrived on, absolutely thrived on. You could tell that the writers got a kick out of it.
Let's hear it.
Excuse me, are you the husband?
Well, not yet, fiance.
Yes. Well, I'm sorry. She's gone.
What's that?
She expired.
Are you sure?
Yes, of course.
So, she's dead.
Yes.
Huh.
Not a lot of character development there going on for George.
No, and that's what makes it funny. I mean, this is like the 1990s equivalent of that famous Jack Benny routine where the mugger comes up to him and says, "Your money or your life?" And there's a long pause and the audience goes crazy and he goes, "What?" And the robber goes, "Well," and he goes, "I'm thinking."
as you said, you know, writers having fun with this. And they tinkered a lot with the format of the show, I'm thinking of. Do you remember when they were just lost in a mall parking lot forever or waiting in it for a table at a restaurant?
At a Chinese restaurant.
Exactly.
Yeah, they did that. They did that a lot. And that's another way in which they paved the way for a lot of these formally innovative shows. Seinfeld was not the same show at the beginning as it was at the end. And it was a much more extreme change. It was a much more deliberate and playful change than what you saw in, say, MASH. Whereas, you know, the television version of MASH started out with a kind of a harder edge, and then it gradually became more and more sensitive and kind of warm and fuzzy as it went along, and as the actors sort of took control and wanted to make their characters more three-dimensional and more likable. But they didn't have these sort of shape-shifting sort of formal innovations like Seinfeld had, where it starts out, it's got a particular kind of three-camera sitcom feel, like a traditional sitcom feel. Then they start doing these self-contained, they're almost like little plays. It's like they're doing Waiting for Godot over and over every week in different ways in those early seasons. And then they start to get more inventive with the choreography of the action, where they're having an A plot and a B plot and sometimes a C plot, and they're cross-cutting between them very, like, with increasing rapidity, to the point where sometimes you'll get even as little as 30 seconds or 45 seconds of one plot line, and then you'll cut to something else, where it becomes almost a purely cinematic experience. And then finally you get to the final stretch of the episodes, and they've kind of gone super-duper meta on us, where the show is not just a show about these characters living in New York City and being selfish and self-interested and manipulative and crazy and silly, but it's also a show about Seinfeld, Seinfeld the show. It is about what it's about, but it is also about itself in a way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, let's get to where the show ultimately got to, the final episode. 76 million people watched the finale, a record at the time that may still hold. All of them having been arrested and in the courtroom, here is the verdict.
I do not know how or under what circumstances the four of you found each other. But your callous indifference and utter disregard for everything that is good and decent has rocked the very foundation upon which our society is built. I can think of nothing more fitting than for the four of you to spend a year removed from society, so that you can contemplate the manner in which you have conducted yourselves. I know I will.
What do you think, Matt Zollersites? Do you think deep down there's a little bit of a evil, self-interested Seinfeld character in all of us, and that's what we might love?
Absolutely. And that's why that I love that ending. That ending was, I think there's a starting to be a consensus forming that that is a great ending, one of the great TV endings. But at the time, people did not think that. And in fact, there was a lot of, I remember, again, when I was at a daily, the audience that read the TV writers there was really drastically divided on the merits of that finale. And a lot of them honestly wanted punishment. They wanted punishment. They wanted the television show to be really like straightforwardly telling these characters, we censure you. We don't approve of you. It's almost like they wanted the show to kind of do its own version of hugging and learning, I suppose, or maybe tough love. And what I love about that clip that you just played is the judge, in a way, I almost feel like the show is mocking the very idea that anybody would want a show to cast judgment upon its characters in that way, because the judge is such a completely humorless, pompous person. And you can hear the audience laughing. Like, the more outraged he gets, the funnier it is. And again, like, when you see them and they're in jail, their reaction is very similar to George learning that his fiancée has died. It's just like it seems to make no impression on them at all.
The Darker Side of Seinfeld with Matt Zollersites. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Matt Zollersites is editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com. He's also TV critic for New York Magazine. That's where we found his article, How Seinfeld Paved the Way for Tony Soprano. You can read it yourself. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Some psychiatrists report a sharp increase in patients who believe that they are the subjects of a 24/7 reality TV show. We're going to learn about this. It's called the Truman Show Delusion, and hear about the provocative hypothesis linking psychosis not only to brain chemistry and genetics, but to culture and environment. That's coming up on Word of Mouth after the break.
Word of Mouth. word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the 1998 film The Truman Show, Jim Carrey plays a man who becomes aware that his entire life has been the subject of a reality television show broadcast 24/7 to billions of people worldwide.
Why don't you let me fix you some of this new Mococo drink? All natural cocoa beans from the upper slopes of Mount Nicaragua, no artificial sweeteners.
What the hell are you talking about? Who are you talking to? Tell me what's happening!
Well, you're having a nervous breakdown. That's what's happening.
You're part of this, aren't you?
A few years after the film, psychiatrist Joel Gold, doctor at Bellevue Hospital, began to notice an increasing number of patients convinced that their lives were being similarly filmed and broadcast to the world. He called it the Truman Show delusion and began to explore its particular character and the nature of delusions and psychosis in general with his brother Ian, a neurophilosopher at McGill. At a time when mental illness is increasingly viewed through the lens of neuroscience and genetics and treated with pharmaceuticals, the Gold brothers explore connections between the development of psychosis and schizophrenia and changes in culture and social life, from bullying to immigration to urban living. It is a new approach to considering the interaction between the brain and the world around us and is covered in a new book called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness. Joel Gold, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now tell us about that very first patient, Albert. This is back in October of 2003. You describe him as your first Truman Show patient.
Yeah, it was Halloween. I remember pretty clearly a Friday. He was admitted to my unit, and he described his life just as you described it. His life was a reality show. In fact, he mentioned The Truman Show. He said, "My life is like The Truman Show." At the time, I didn't make too much of it. It was fascinating. He had come to New York from out of state. His idea was that if he had come and found that the Twin Towers were still standing, he would know that even the attacks of 9/11 were essentially a put-on for him just to get a reaction for the show. Mm. But if they were in fact destroyed, he would acknowledge that perhaps he was delusional, which is actually somewhat unusual for people to have that insight that they might be ill. When he came to New York, unfortunately for him, he didn't get to the World Trade Center. He got as far as the United Nations, and at that point he decided to seek asylum from the show by going to the UN. A scuffle ensued, and he was brought to Bellevue. Again, I didn't make too much of it, as we see so many fascinating delusions at Bellevue. But over the course of time, I saw more and more of these patients and started connecting the dots. Mm.
More and more people saying, you know, my father is an actor paid to play my father. The people around me are actors. But is this delusion just a new name for an old delusion? Would it have been called something different in the 1950s or 60s?
Absolutely. We looked into this over the course of the writing of the book, and initially, we weren't really sure if this was something new or something that had existed. There's a form and content question, and we discovered that over the course of time, there were only a handful, maybe a dozen forms of delusion: paranoid or persecutory, grandiose, religious, etc. And many people believed, and we came to believe, that over the course of time, as culture changes, so too do the delusions, the content changes. So in the backdrop of the Cold War, for instance, people might have thought that the KGB were after them, or that the CIA had implanted a microchip in their tooth. As we now live in a society of reality television and surveillance, that has now come to fill in the blanks, so to speak, of these kinds of delusions. And initially, we had the thought that it was a more of a persecutory and grandiose delusion. As time passed, we came to think of it as more of a delusion of control, wherein people feel like they're not really in control of their own lives.
Now, we see these kind of cycles of belief, of where madness is coming from. Is it spirit? Is it the brain structure? Is it environmental factors? How does this history and those cycles inform your theory?
That's a wonderful question. And absolutely, over the course of time, things have changed. We often think of psychiatry as having started with Sigmund Freud and psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, and then the advent of psychotropic medications in the 60s, 70s, and beyond. But in fact, before that, in ancient times and really up until Freud, it was very much like it is today, very much a biological approach. Something is wrong with the brain. And people would, you know, bore holes in skulls and, you know, the kind of bleeding with leeches approach, that there was something wrong with the humors. Now we've returned clearly with a vengeance to the biological model. And I'm not at all opposed. I worked at Bellevue and I was very comfortable prescribing antipsychotic medication to my patients who were suffering from delusions and hallucinations. But I believe that the pendulum has swung too far in the direction of the biological, both in terms of the cause of psychosis and the treatment. So I think that it's very important not just to look at the biological underpinnings, but the environmental contributors to one developing psychosis, schizophrenia, for instance, and that you can actually do talk therapy of a kind with psychotic individuals and get results. And it's not simply reaching for the prescription pad.
So let's get into that theory. Your theory is that we need to look beyond neurology or genetics to consider psychosis and schizophrenia to cultural or cognitive factors. And this leads to your research into evolutionary psychology, and you come up with this hypothesis about the suspicion system that gives the book its title. So what is the suspicion system? What is its function?
Well, we believe that there's a part of the brain, and we have no particular sense of what the anatomy is, though we might guess at it. But this function is something that evolutionarily has developed in order to act as a kind of an alarm that will detect danger in the environment, particularly social danger. But when that system goes awry, instead of being able to question those initial thoughts, like someone's walking in the forest, if you hear that crack, you quickly turn around. Mm-hmm. Is it an animal that's chasing after me? And you think, no, it's just the wind. That's what we call the reflective system, the slower ability to reflect on that initial impulse. But if that initial impulse doesn't shut down, it becomes hypertrophy to the point where it really is now a delusion that's very firmly held.
So the system that we as human beings have to fear the Bengal tiger, I guess, in the woods,
right,
suddenly factors in our whole place inside of a social structure.
Yeah. In times long ago, people lived in, you know, villages, small towns, and there's some research that suggests that our brain is only able to really fit about 125 or 150 people in there. And what I mean by that is, if you live in a small town with about 100, 150 people, you pretty much know most of the people in it, if not all of them. And so you can feel a little bit more comfortable. But as cities grow in number, there are more unknown others. And when there are unknown others, there's a sense that they may mean to do us harm. And so this system becomes more important in a sense. And there is evidence that the larger the city one lives in, the greater the incidence of psychosis and schizophrenia. It's actually well established, much like living in a large city might put one at higher risk for lung cancer because the air is not as clean. People don't really know about this, including psychiatrists and psychiatric researchers, that certain environmental factors such as living in an urban environment, being an immigrant, or being a survivor of child abuse makes one higher at higher risk for developing psychosis later in life. And these are, again, environmental factors, much like smoking cigarettes is for lung cancer and heart disease.
What is the role of culture in influencing delusions, psychoses, or schizophrenia? Joel Gold and his brother Ian have been researching that very topic and the incidence of something they call the Truman Show delusion. It's covered in a new book called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness. You're looking at delusions as a malfunctioning response to a social environment, right?
Absolutely. So
what is that? What is the relationship to that and the Truman Show delusion? What purpose does that serve?
If things feel not quite right, one has to be on their guard. Again, like the Bengal tiger you referenced, if there are all of these people and they seem a bit strange, I don't know, they're looking at me, they're making signs, maybe there's something going on here. And then perhaps you see or remember the movie, it inflames the suspicion system, so to speak. And instead of, oh, I don't know, maybe I'm just having a strange day, I didn't get a good night's sleep. If someone has, again, these risk factors, suddenly they may be using the Truman Show effect to act as a kind of scaffolding for their feelings. But if we become so much on guard that we're not able to step out of it, we have these persecutory ideas. And then for, again, a number of these younger people, late teens, early 20s, who may be inching into psychosis, the Truman Show might resonate with them in a sense, and they say, yes, this is my life. And it's very hard to move them out of that.
Joel, very early in the book, you say that you are seeking some balance in the conversation about the role that genetics and neurobiology play as compared to experience, culture, society, environment. But I know in my life and probably the lives of many others, there are people close to us with mental illness, and in many ways, acknowledging the role of biology and genetics destigmatizes, depersonalizes, takes away this sense of fault or shame. So what's the balance in that conversation?
Oh, I think that's such an important point. For many years, particularly during the height of psychoanalytic theory, there was the notion of the schizophrenogenic mother, the cold, uncaring, aggressive mother who would actually induce schizophrenia in their child. And for many years, this was obviously not true and very, very painful for families who were either enraged because they knew it wasn't the case, that they were loving parents, loving siblings, or intense guilt. What did I do? Maybe I should have done this or that and my child would be well. So in that regard, the biolization of psychosis and schizophrenia was a wonderful thing for those patients and their families. At the same time, it would be irresponsible of us to recognize that there are environmental factors. Most families of schizophrenic patients have loving, wonderful families, but that's not to say that there aren't, unfortunately, some kids who are severely abused, and those kids who are abused are at higher risk. So we're not painting everyone with a broad brush, but that's just the fact. But we want to make it clear we're not suggesting that because we want to look at the environment and culture that we're pointing fingers at family members. If someone lives in an urban environment and therefore, you know, including myself, you're in New Hampshire, I'm in New York, and in that sense I'm at higher risk for developing schizophrenia than you are, one could say, well, am I being unfair to my kids by choosing to live in a large city? Perhaps I should move to, you know, a bucolic town and lower their risk. But most of us don't do that. And so we have to live in the world in which we do. And I think this is something that very, very challenging for families and for patients.
Joel Gold, thank you so much for joining us.
Great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Joel Gold and his brother Ian have together written a book called Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness. There's much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Last month, the American Heart Association released a report indicating that adults who watch TV for 3 or more hours each day are twice as likely to die at a younger age. As alarming as that headline may be for the average viewer, imagine if it were your job to watch hours and hours of television every day. The New York Times film critic Neil Gunslinger says that from here on out, he's turning his back on the confusing world of research about TV habits. And you should too. Neil, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thanks.
Okay, so a report begins. A new study finds that watching TV could ... What's your first thought? Run in the other direction?
That is pretty much my first thought, especially with this new study, which essentially said watching TV will kill you. That's particularly alarming to read that for someone who watches TV for a living.
Well, you've got to understand the impulse. I mean, we'd like to know how something as habitual as TV is affecting our lives, right?
It's true. My personal feeling is that television has kind of entered the phase that some other things are already in, things like food. I haven't eaten in years because I can't keep track of which foods are good for you this week and which foods are not good for you. So the only thing to do is just to stop eating. It seems like there's a new study every week or every couple of weeks on their effects, and they're so ingrained in our lives anyway that it's not as if they're going to disappear. So you can either spend your whole life trying to keep track of these studies, or you can just try to use common sense, which is what I've decided to go with from now on.
Well, I've always wondered how TV critics find time to see so many programs. So what do you guess on average? How much television do you watch for your job?
How much do I personally watch?
Yes.
So 5 hours a day anyway.
So should I just clarify, you're not overweight, have diabetes, or a teen mom?
I am none of those things. I weigh 148 pounds, and when I'm not watching TV, I run half marathons. So that's my version of common sense. I watch a lot of TV, but I try to actually get some exercise when I'm not watching TV, and that's really what this new study is telling people. You can't sit on the couch all day, every day, and expect to be healthy, and you shouldn't need a study to tell you that.
Okay, I know you said you'd like to steer clear of these, but I wonder if I could get your take on some of the TV-based research headlines from the past couple of years. Can we go through some of those?
Sure.
Okay, TV, a sleep detriment in children study finds. Any thoughts?
I have a couple of children, and sometimes they didn't sleep well. I'm not sure how that study pinned that on television as opposed to on a million other things that could be going on in a child's head. Kids are complicated machines, and it's hard to imagine that a single thing like television is responsible for everything that's wrong with them or everything that's right with them. That's the thing about these studies. They sometimes contradict one another. You can find a study that says television makes kids stupider, but you can also find a study that says television makes kids smarter.
Okay, how about TV in the bedroom equals better sex, study finds?
I'm not sure I've seen that one, but I'd like to. I suppose it could be possible. Depends on the couple, I would think. And
I'm guessing the viewing as well.
Yes, and what they're watching. Johnny Carson, of course, used to make that. That was a running joke, you know, about children that had been conceived because he was boring people too much and they decided to stop watching, that kind of stuff.
So, Neil, what if you were a researcher looking at the effects of television on people's lives? What would you study?
I am more interested in the positive effects of television, and not because I'm trying to boost television, but I particularly think of my mother, who is 94 years old, still gets around, but not that much, watches some fair amount of TV to keep engaged. She'll want to talk about whatever the latest show is. For people like that, television is, is a good thing. I think it's a lifeline. It's a way to stay connected, and broadening the cultural horizons of people is an important function for television. I think 100 years ago, you lived in your little town or whatever, and you really didn't know a lot about what other people, other races, other religions thought or felt. Film, radio, and certainly now television has broken down a lot of those barriers. Some people might think that's a negative. I don't. I think it's a positive. I think exposure to the world is a positive thing.
Well, Neil, you'll be very pleased to note that we just discovered Pacific Standards has a headline at this moment, "Can TV Improve Your Health?" So,
well, there you go.
Here we go. The backs and the fours. Neil Gensinger, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
Neil Gensinger, TV critic for The New York Times. He also reviews films and theater on occasion. You'll find a link to read his article, Why the Research on Viewing is Best Ignored, along with a list of our favorite contradictory television studies. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us. We're keeping the TV on for a conversation with an artist who power watched all 20 seasons of Law and Order in just a year and a half. It was his way of measuring computer creep into our culture. So don't touch that dial. You'll hear the story when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The early 21st century may well be remembered in the entertainment world as the birth of binge watching. Whether the habit of hitting next episode actually improves the experience is up for debate. But for one artist, it's a window into history. In an effort to explore our cultural relationship with computer technology, artist and art professor Jeff Thompson watched 20 years worth of Law and Order, a total of 456 episodes, and documented when computers were used and how.
The police who investigate crime and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders. These are their stories.
The computer age.
They made mistakes before computers.
Mixing up a homicidal maniac and a turnstile jumper?
Bruno Walker. Sounds like Brutus Walker.
Yeah, only Brutus carries bigger guns. Here.
The project was commissioned by the arts and technology organization Rhizome, and Jeff joins us now to tell us more. Jeff, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
So why Law and Order?
There are so many reasons. Law and Order is this kind of perfect mirror for looking at culture. We think of TV as maybe being too artificial or fake, but Law and Order, it's ripped from the headlines format. It's meant to really kind of mirror what's happening now. And unlike a movie, which only lasts an hour and a half and has kind of a single plot point, Law and Order spans 20 years. So we have this huge kind of archive to draw on. Since it started in 1990, that's kind of the rise of the PC being really common. And throughout the 20 years of the show, we can see the PC, laptops, internet use, smartphones, those kinds of things. It's this perfect kind of period in technological history as well. Mm.
You told The Atlantic that Law and Order is the perfect artifact for exploring the history of our relationship to computers. So does this make you a sort of, I don't know, digital archaeologist?
I think so, yeah. I mean, there's things that we've written a lot about, like mainframe computers, the early history of computing, or cloud computing issues now. But the more mundane things like a computer desk or how people would use computers together or where they might be placed in a room, that kind of stuff we don't write about, we don't even really think about. But a TV show like Law and Order is a perfect way that we can go back in history and kind of observe those things that were included in the show without ever really being thought about. It's just reflecting how we use those at that time.
So tell us a little bit about that. How did you see the computer desk being used through 20 years of Law and Order?
So anyone who's used a computer in the 80s or 90s remembers these kind of fake wood, specialized kind of furniture. You'd buy it at a computer store, which also used to be a thing. And, you know, would have things like a keyboard tray or slots for CD-ROMs and stuff like that. So it's this very particular kind of piece of furniture that doesn't exist anymore. So in the early episodes, you see computers on these dedicated kinds of things. They're tucked away in the corner of a room. They're shared amongst an entire office, or occasionally someone has their own computer. And by the end of the show, you know, everyone's using laptops at their own desk. So things like the computer desk, you could see it vanish.
Yeah, it used to never be at the same desk where a person sat.
Right. I mean, part of the reason might be you have these huge monitors, but I think, too, that it was this kind of rude thing. You wouldn't use a computer while talking to somebody. So you see in the early parts of the show, you know, someone will maybe turn to use the computer to look something up. But really, I think it would be kind of rude to be interacting with this thing. And, of course, by the end, we have the total opposite, which is people distractedly checking their phones to read their email and stuff like that.
There are, in total, 456 episodes of Law and Order. How long did it take you to watch all 20 seasons? Tell us about that process.
It took about a year and a half. Each episode is about 45 minutes long. I did watch the show at 150% speed, so about half again as fast.
Wait a minute. Can you understand what people say? Was it all sped up?
Yeah, that's about the threshold at which it's still enjoyable to watch. I mean, it drove my wife crazy hearing it in the background. But it saved me somewhere around 100 hours watching it like that.
So I guess you weren't really watching for the dialogue. You were sort of scanning for computers?
No, I mean, I was watching it, and along the way, I gathered a total of about 11,000 screenshots of computers, but also quotes about computers and technology on the show. I recorded instances of firsts, so the first laptop, that kind of thing.
You need tools to write a thesis?
No, I use a laptop computer to write a thesis. I use tools to fix my VCR and my toaster.
So any moments stand out for you as you're scanning through all of this material at 1.5 speed when you sort of notice, oh, a computer, great?
Yeah, so there's some really interesting ones. The first computer ever appears in the first episode. So it starts from the very beginning. It's not turned on. And in fact, we see computers not turned on through a good portion of the show, especially the first half of the show. Most computers aren't. The first computer is turned on in the 9th episode of the first season. And then throughout, we see things appear like the dot matrix printer in the 2nd season, people talking about BBS systems and the word download in the 3rd season.
So like old bulletin board kind of things, yeah.
CD-ROMs appearing in the 7th season, the first BlackBerry in season 12, season 12 being about 2002. And then by the end of the show, we see Gmail pop up in the 17th season, the first thumb drive in the 2nd to last. The first iPhone and the 2nd to last.
We have talked on this program about how binge watching can change the way that we consume television. It is interesting to think that it could be changing its artistic or historical value. Do you think that this experiment of yours has added value to this television show?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think I identify as an artist. I see this project as certainly falling under my studio practice. It also falls under cultural analysis, media history, other things too, which I find interesting. But as an artist, I think not knowing exactly what it is, what these screenshots mean as a whole, that's interesting to me, that I can look at them and see one kind of thing. Somebody else might look at these images having a different history with computers and might find a totally different narrative.
What are some other programs, or maybe even types of programs, that might reveal important cultural shifts and technological shifts when viewed in this archaeological way? And, you know, Sex and the City, Jeopardy, anything else come to mind for you?
I don't know. I've been thinking about that a lot over the last few weeks. Somebody mentioned Murder, She Wrote, which I never watched, which might be interesting. I mean, even I think the spinoffs of Law and Order aren't, like SVU, are not nearly as good for this kind of thing. They have a more sci-fi sort of relationship to technology. And I don't know if that has to do with when it started or just the structure of the show. I mean, I think you could find different things in different kinds of shows depending on what you're looking for. So if you're looking for accurate representations, that's much harder. If you're looking for what we imagine technology being like, you have a lot more to choose from. Jeopardy would be really interesting, somehow analyzing every question on the show or something.
I wonder if when you're in public places now or offices, you immediately notice, you kind of case the joint for what kind of technology is around you.
It's actually so much worse than that. Whenever I watch TV or a movie, I built a little device to capture the screenshots just because it made it easier. So it's sort of a touch sensor. And now when I'm watching TV completely unrelated, I have this sort of reflex to reach out and hit the button, and I feel it in my arm, and it's driving me crazy.
Well, Jeff Thompson, I'm sure you'll be onto something else at some point.
Absolutely.
You can read much more about Jeff's project and see links to that Tumblr, which is where he's been recording and documenting computers on Law and Order, as well as the essay he mentioned. Links are all at wordofmouthradio.org.
Type in what we're looking for, Eagle Graphics, and the motto, Our Dentist, Fortuna, Juva. Search engine does the rest. If it's anywhere on the internet, we'll get a hit.
One of these days, you have to teach me how to play solitaire on that thing.
Bingo. This shows us where to find it.
Let's surf the net.
Okay, so while you may not want to binge watch all 20 seasons of Law and Order, there is something comforting about diving into a Sunday afternoon Seinfeld marathon or old episodes of The Simpsons. Now, we did hear from the New York Times TV critic Neil Genslinger that we should not pay attention to studies about watching television. But this one had a certain appeal. The upshot, watching reruns does not only kill time, it also improves your self-control. Yep. Tom Jacobs is staff writer with Pacific Standard.
Okay, this is a study done by psychologist Jay Derrick. She's at the Research Institute on Addictions at the University of Buffalo. Her study is one of quite a number that have been done in recent years about impulse control and the fact that we now think impulse control is a limited resource.
In other words, your self-control is like a gas tank that gets depleted the more you use it. So if you've resisted that slice of birthday cake at the office all afternoon, you are more likely to give into a big bowl of ice cream after dinner at home.
The question then becomes, how do you replenish your self-control? Once it's depleted, how do you get it back? And she found a surprising answer to that, which is watching reruns on television.
Smelly cat, what are they feeding you? Everybody, smelly cat.
Okay, then, how did researchers determine that plunking oneself on the couch for an hour in front of familiar characters and laugh tracks helps recharge your batteries?
The shorthand answer, I think, is the researchers stressed a bunch of people out by giving them a deliberately difficult assignment. They had to write an essay without using the letters A or I. Then half of those people were asked to describe their favorite TV show. Okay, afterwards, everybody then took a subsequent test that required a great amount of self-discipline. And they found that the people who had thought about and talked about their favorite television show did far better than the others. Getting into the world of their favorite TV show, even for a couple minutes, put them in a better mood and seems to have restored their self-control to its normal level.
Reruns as restorative? We wanted to find out whether, with all that's available to watch, people still turn to reruns. So we conducted a completely unscientific poll around the office and then hit the streets of Concord to ask people if they revisit tried and true shows and why.
George Lopez.
Yeah, I like Family Guy.
Probably Seinfeld.
Nothing for you!
Probably Two and a Half Men. I could watch that all day.
You also like to watch Family Guy.
Oh, Family Guy.
Over.
I could watch Family Guy all day.
Doctor Who, Buffy, Arrested Development.
Is there like a movie that you've watched over and over
the
again?
Princess Bride.
Hello.
I can quote it easily.
My name is Inigo Montoya.
That and Clue. 1+1+2+1.
One thing that I've actually started to really do with Scrubs was I would watch the show and I'd sort of not pay attention to what was in the front and I'd just watch the background and I started to notice how like they had the same kind of B-roll list of people always like walking through in the back and it's like exactly these carbon copy things. It's just like this random doctor guy walking through, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's pretty funny.
It's like all of a sudden this hospital's a police state.
I mean, next thing you know, they're going to be charging doctors for candy at the gift shop.
They do charge doctors for candy at the gift shop, Elliot.
You can just know that you're going to enjoy what it is that you're watching, and you can spend that time laughing as opposed to wondering if you're going to laugh or wondering what the plot line is. You already know what it is, and you can just sit back and enjoy it. It's a lot less energy.
Thank you to everyone willing to admit their guilty pleasures. Who knew it could be so good for you? As for Pacific Standard's Tom Jacobs, who told us about the rerun study, what's his favorite program for boosting self-control?
Well, I'm a Simpsons fan, so especially some of the classic seasons from the 90s, yeah.
Thinking along the lines of no TV and no beer, make Homer something something.
Go crazy.
Don't mind if I do.
I wish that I knew what I know.
Well, that about does it for today's show. From Seinfeld as anti-hero archetype to the psychological benefits of watching reruns, who knew TV on the radio could be so fascinating? And we would love to hear from you. Which TV shows do you think are worth a second viewing? Are there certain shows you stop and watch no matter how many times you've seen an episode? Maybe you've binge-watched the new season of Orange is the New Black, or maybe a crackly old rerun of The Big Valley. Tell us what you could watch again and again on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter, @wordofmouth. After all the best pleasures, guilty or otherwise, travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for Word of Mouth on NHPR or online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.